So the next section is verses 8 through 10, and that's three levels of motivation or three stages of motivation for practice. To avoid suffering is like the first thing that turns us to the Dharma, and to avoid suffering, we refrain from harm to other beings. Second level of practice is cultivating liberation, like striving to liberate ourselves because we realize that even the happiness in samsara is tainted with suffering. And then the third level is remembering that if we liberate ourselves, which is a really good thing to do, all other beings are still suffering. So we cultivate what's called the mind of full awakening, which is both, you know, which includes compassion and includes bringing everybody else with us. So that brings us onto the Mahayana path. And then after that, we have action bodhicitta, which is how we actually do this, how we put our motivation into practice. And it starts with taking and sending, which is verse 11. And there are summaries of all of these groups in different posts on the website, so you can find them. Taking and sending is our main tool of action bodhicitta. Like when we encounter any kind of adversity, whenever we're upset about anything, we go straight to taking and sending, exchanging our happiness for others' suffering. And that's verse 11. We spent 3 weeks on that. And then the next verses 12 through 19 are specific situations where we'd apply taking and sending. Like if somebody steals all of your stuff, if somebody, you know, openly criticizes you, if somebody cuts off your head, somebody jumps on you when you haven't done anything wrong and so forth, or when everything is going wrong, you're sick and, you know, and everybody hates you at the same time and you've lost all your things. Bodhisattva boot camp, I call it Bodhisattva boot camp, where Tokme Zangpo gives us specific situations and says, yes, you would apply taking and sending here too. Like no matter how you feel, taking and sending is actually the right answer. And that's really helpful because it gives us practice in confronting specific situations. It's not just an abstract idea anymore. But when this happens, yes, taking and sending, and different takes on taking and sending. So that's 12 through 19, and then 20 and 21, actually 20 through 22. 22 is a hinge verse that belongs to the set before it and the set after it. So 20 through 22 are the three poisons, how to free ourselves from the three poisons. First of aggression, second of attachment, and then third, ignorance, which is seeing the world in a dualistic way. And so that third poison, which is the primary poison of ego clinging, in verse 22 becomes the first verse of the ultimate bodhicitta verses, how to connect with ultimate reality, even in the midst of relative reality. So in the first verse, verse 22, it's just overall, like, what do we do on the cushion? And what we do on the cushion... people may have their verses in front of them, but it's all appearances are my own mind. And this is bringing us into this class now because we've been on hiatus for a couple of weeks and we have a couple of new people joining us. We're going to review the ultimate bodhicitta verses as a whole and then focus on verse 24, the last of those verses. So verse 22 is how do we practice on the cushion or the chair to cultivate ultimate bodhicitta, to cultivate a connection with ultimate reality. So the answer is, all appearances are my own mind. So when we're on the cushion, we're in meditation, we rest in a state of knowing all appearances to be our own mind. All appearances are my own mind, and we're looking at mind's nature, right? That's what we did in the meditation based on Ken McLeod's commentary earlier. Mind's nature from the start is concept free. So we realize all appearances are my mind, and then we look at mind itself, and there's nothing there that we can identify. We can't say where anything is located or what it is, really. And so the instruction is to know exactly this, to be aware of, to keep our mind there, and not engage in grasping onto subject-object signs, which means not... It means to allow ourselves to let go of dualistic grasping, like the object is out there and my mind is here. And we let that dissolve a bit. We let that fade through meditations like Ken's. And this is the way a bodhisattva trains, is to let go of subject-object fixation, to let go What that means is to let go of conceptuality. Whenever we have, you know, as we know in meditation, thoughts are always allowed, but those are single thoughts, like a thought, a thought, a thought. They're not related to each other. We allow them. Once we start turning it into two thoughts, three thoughts, Lama Narla Rinpoche once said to me, if you follow the second thought, then the third thought is inevitable. You're just stuck in conceptuality. That was one of the most helpful things he ever said to me. It's like, right, you let, it's like the pig in the garden. I think we talked about that in at KDC recently, that there's a saying in Tibetan, you know, whatever, that if the pig gets into the garden, you've got to get him out before he starts eating. Because once he starts eating, you can't get him out of the garden, and he'll always come back. So it's like that. We just stop at the first thought. And then, of course, we find ourselves making chains of thoughts. The practice is, as soon as we realize we're caught up in thoughts and distraction, we just go back to our object. And so our object here is basically non-duality. It's basically letting go of whatever conceptuality arises in our mind. We're going to that state of resting in mind's nature, which from the start is concept-free, according to the verse. And that's how we train in meditation, in formal meditation, which we can then, of course, extend to daily activity. Whenever you find yourself caught up in conceptuality, like you're about to get into an argument with somebody, you could go, let's let go of subject-object fixation here and just be in the moment and respond in the moment and not from some fixed set of I'm right and you're wrong, or it is this way and not that way. That is conceptuality. All of our judgments, all of our opinions, all of our certainties, every certainty we have, that's what we're letting go of. And we can do it on the cushion, and we can do it in regular life. And so that leads to verses 23 and 24, which are how to do that in what's called post-meditation or between sessions when you're not on the cushion or the chair. So when you're going about your daily life, you might run into something pleasant, because we know from the skandhas, right, from the five skandhas, that the second skandha is everything that we encounter. The first skandha is form, which is everything. As soon as we encounter it, we have an immediate reaction of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So when we have the pleasant reaction, then we invoke verse 23, which is, when I encounter something that's delightful, such as a rainbow on a summer day, or a sunset, or a delicious piece of pie, to give up all attachment to its beauty and never cling to it is truly real. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. So to me, like, it's a very clear instruction, but it's also very interesting in that it doesn't say we have to avoid the pleasure. You don't have to turn your back on the pleasure. The pleasure is not evil. You know, it's not what's keeping you in samsara. You could totally enjoy it, but you have to enjoy it from the point of view of verse 22, that there's no solid reality to it. It's going to be a fleeting experience. It's not going to last, and it's not something that you can pin down. You could never find the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, because the end of the rainbow doesn't really exist. The rainbow doesn't really exist. So to give up all attachment to pleasant, whatever pleasant thing we encounter, we simply drop the attachment to it and don't cling to it as truly real. And that harks back, these two verses, 23 and 24, actually reflect 20 and 21. 23 takes us back to verse 21, is how do you deal with objects of desire on the path? Sense pleasures and desire are like salt water. The more I drink them in, the more I crave. So what do we do with them? The moment that attachment stirs, we drop it. Same thing. That's exactly what we're being told to do in verse 23 as well as verse 21. And just in verse 23, we're into the ultimate bodhicitta aspect. We're remembering that. So our experience is enriched by that realization that it's all emptiness. I see your hand, John, and I'm going to find you and unmute you, or you can unmute yourself. Where are you? Oh, there you are. Okay. Okay, you're unmuted.
I have a question about verse 23. In the book on page 147, it has a line there that says, right above the last paragraph in the first column, craving by its nature brings only trouble and dissatisfaction. So I was wondering if you can expound on that.
Okay, I'm on page 147, and where did you say that the line is? Oh, I see, I got it. The end of the last sentence in the second paragraph.
Correct.
Craving by its nature brings only trouble and dissatisfaction. So you want me to explain that sentence?
Just the like the drinking salt water?
Yeah.
You craving it? But yeah. All right, then what about if you have a craving and maybe it's for chocolate and then you just have one piece of chocolate and it's fine. You know that craving's temporary, but the chocolate's temporary too, and they cancel out.
Right. Well, you could, I mean, if you can do that, then you're already there. Like, then you don't even need to have a question about it. If you can eat that one piece of chocolate that's available to you and be happy with that, and you have your chocolate, then you're totally good. That's what it means. But for many of us, the one piece of chocolate is not going to be enough. And having one piece of chocolate makes us want another piece of chocolate. It's like, you know, the old potato chip commercial. You can't just eat one. Like, they want you to be like that. They want you to have attachment to that craving for potato chips or chocolate. And so you ate the whole bag of potato chips, or you ate the whole bar of chocolate, or you had to go to school. I'm just going to mute you because of the noise, background noise. Or you have to get in your car and go to the store and get more chocolate. Or you can't get more chocolate and you're miserable because you want chocolate. All of those things are like what happens if you do have attachment. So if you can just eat the one piece of chocolate, you're good. You get to enjoy it totally. It's that craving for the second piece, like that's just never satisfied. It's like, you know, how we know that when people have a lot of money, it doesn't satisfy. They never feel like they have enough. I mean, we may experience that ourselves. You know, it's like we have everything we could possibly need. And it's like, you know, the bathroom could really use remodeling. You know, I'm not really happy with that tile. It's so outdated. I just had my bathroom torn out last year, and it was quite a miserable experience. And it wasn't from craving. I would just as soon not have done it. It was really rotting. But anyway, does that answer your question, John, or is there more that you'd like to explore here?
That answers that part. But then I kind of wonder, because for myself anyway, that I get to a point where good things can happen, and it's like I'm almost immune to it. I don't know what the word would be, that it's so even keel that I don't express that happiness because I don't know why, but I do. And it could be just like a flat line, you know, just happy or not happy. It's just as things are, and you can become very, I don't know, dull, unexpressive, or I don't know. Am I missing something here?
Right. Okay. So that brings us back to, I think the whole idea that like enlightenment is like this very neutral state, like free of emotion and free of, you know, pleasures and displeasures. And I don't think it's like that at all. We see, for example, that realized teachers that we know, they all have very distinct personalities and, you know, relative likes and dislikes. But they're not attached to having things be that way. So I'm not sure. What I can say is that I don't think we're striving for a state of neutrality, like where we don't care, we don't enjoy pleasant things, we don't even go so far as to enjoy pleasant things or not enjoy unpleasant things. We're allowed to have those feelings. But where we get into trouble is where we want things to be a certain way and it upsets us when they're not that way. Or something, we encounter some adversity and we're upset and we suffer because that adversity is there and we want it to be different. I don't know if this is really answering your question. I think that there are certain states, and I'm not saying this about you, but like a depressed person doesn't feel pleasure. Like that could be for some people a sign of depression that they don't, like something wonderful happens and they just don't relate to it. I don't think equanimity is that kind of a state. I think equanimity is a very vivid state. Like you're vividly aware of things and you can enjoy things. You would enjoy a pleasant thing. Rinpoche loved momos. you know, he's very happy when he was eating momos, but like when the momos are done, the momos are done. So I'm going to check in with you again, John. Is there anything further there that you want to talk about?
Nope, that's fine. That's good.
Okay. It's just something to keep exploring because these things, they sound very simple, but when we try to integrate them into our lives, we find, as John is expressing here, they're not that simple. A lot of experiences may arise and we could be not clear about the meaning of, say, one of these pieces of advice in a particular situation. How it plays out. Yes, Charlotte, I'm unmuting you.
Okay. Well, one thing I've noticed from, you know, just the path of meditation, you know, it's like an onion unpeeling or whatever, layers of becoming more aware. I think it's just a heightened awareness the more you study, well, the more I've studied Buddhism anyway. So, but at the same time, like if you have, you know, the thing about adversity in the verses where, you know, like if you're suffering and you just accept it, but it's like if you're, if you have an illness, let's just say, mm-hmm. like I just had a serious illness, I've had a few serious illnesses since I've moved to New York, you know, multiple surgeries, things like that. And, you know, you do kind of get to a point where you just like let go and you just like go with the flow and you're not going to fight, you know, you just accept this is what's happening. And, you know, and actually Buddhism got me through it. I think very, a lot more calm. Everybody said, you're so calm.
Like, you're just not fighting it, right? You're just not fighting.
You're not fighting it. But at the same time, you're still suffering.
Yeah. Still well, pain. Yeah.
So yeah. You're still in that samsara. Yeah. So like what, I mean, but it's not supposed to be real.
Right. Well, I think you just hit on a very important point. I think you just hit on a very, I'm just going to mute you to avoid any extra noise, but I think you've hit on a very important point. And I think it's a really important distinction that I think when the Buddha said in the First Noble Truth that all of our experience contains suffering or that there is suffering, we're making the distinction between suffering and the actual like physical pain or, you know, or feeling of like things need to be a different way. We do what we can. Like, well, I have the same experience as you. I have a physical condition that can lead me to be like in really severe pain for long extended periods of time. And at a certain point, like when you can let go of fighting it and feeling like this should not be happening to me, I should be able to function like everybody else and not be in pain. When you stop that, then pain, physical pain becomes, it's just another sensation. It's an unpleasant sensation. I did not get beyond pleasant and unpleasant there, but you're not attached anymore to it in the sense of fighting against it and feeling like it needs to be different. We need to get rid of this thing. You just are able to be in the moment and in whatever experience the moment is offering without fighting against it. And also knowing that it's fleeting, like in whatever way it's fleeting, it's impermanent. So I think it's the fighting that's the suffering. You know, I think we're talking about something that's on top of like the actual adversity of the experience itself, which is going to be unpleasant or is going to be pleasant. Maybe at a very high realization, you don't even have that. But I think the suffering is what we add on top. I think that Pema Chodron has expressed it like that. Like it's the spinning, it's the mental spinning that is the suffering. And the experience itself can be a good or a bad experience, but you don't have to add more suffering on top of it by being miserable about your pain. Anything further there, Charlotte?
Yeah, but at the same, but Mike, I'm wondering, you know, like the whole thing of duality of existence and things not being real. And we are, you know, our body is kind of the shell that carries around our spirit, our, you know, self. But it feels real.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you can go with it, like Mingo Rinpoche was in New York a few years ago, and he was talking about how he almost died and how he had that thing where he just sort of got past it and took him to a new level of awareness. Like, it can be a wonderful teaching experience going through physical pain and adversity, but it's still, I mean, it's real. I mean,
yeah.
How can you differentiate? My question is between, you know, like, how can you say to yourself, you can accept it and go with it and just say, okay, it's just something over here that I'm dealing with, it's there with me. But how can, is it not real, or is it real?
I think this is actually the crux of the teachings. You know, this is, so we've talked a lot about relative reality and ultimate reality. So here we're in ultimate reality versus, we're seeing things as, we're understanding that at some level, at some underlying level, whatever's happening to us is not ultimately real. But very important to remember that ultimate reality does not negate relative reality. They're integrated. So what we're doing when we're not fighting against it is we can connect with the ultimate level of reality. It does not make the relative reality go away. They're always both there. They're both equal. They're both equally valid. So, you know, appearances and emptiness, reality is appearances and emptiness unified. You know, you still got to deal with the appearances. But the way that the most effective way to deal with them, and what the 7 points of mind training calls our ultimate protection against suffering, is recognizing the ultimate level of reality, which is there's really nothing solid happening here. It's like a fleeting experience. It's not something that you can totally define. The more that we can stay in touch with ultimate reality through our relative experience, the less we're going to suffer. But we're never going to get rid of relative reality. And relative reality is always going to include adversity. You know, even the highest lamas have adversity. They have illness, they have obstacles, and so forth. But the way that they get through them unscathed is by staying in touch with ultimate reality, which permeates all of it. Does that help?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's okay. Perfect. Yeah. It explains it. It's kind of a fleeting concept, even ultimate reality.
Yeah, it is. And we have to keep touching back into it. And the way we touch back into it is verse 22. All appearances are my own mind. It hurts like hell, but like in some sense, it's my own mind, and mind's nature is concept free. So you just let go of the concepts about it. You let go of the why me. You let go of, you know, being angry at the doctor. You let go of all the conceptuality, and you're left only with the experience itself, like the raw texture of the experience. And we can't, that's the part that we can't, like, ultimate reality does not negate that. But through ultimate reality, it can't really hurt us. It can't really harm us. It can't really distract us. So we're always going back to verse 22, remembering, I'm experiencing all of this through my mind, and my mind has no concept. So I let go of concepts, and I'm just going to rest in the experience. And that's how we do it. And that is, I'd say that that's a pretty good summation of the 37 practices. All right, anybody else before we take a look at some commentaries? Okay, Joanne, I'm unmuting you.
I think when we reach ultimate bodhicitta, that we're in emptiness. And I think that is something I'm working on, reading the Heart Sutra. There's various commentaries, but I'm trying to, I don't know if I can ever grasp it. It's hard. That's a challenge.
You can't grasp it intellectually.
No.
So that's the thing. That's the you can't say part. You can't say where the sound is taking place. You can't say who's having this experience. That's the emptiness. That's the you can't say. That's the ultimate bodhicitta that permeates everything. But so then why do we go through this exercise of having a class and studying the text? Because by understanding the framework, which is called the view, we can then understand our experience as we experience it. It's like guideposts, but it's the experience itself that we have to cultivate. And actually, I'm glad you brought up the Heart Sutra. I recommend to everybody that they read the Heart Sutra. Maybe, you know, if you can, if you have it, chant it every day. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Form is not other than emptiness, emptiness is not other than form. That's the exact statement of relative bodhicitta and ultimate bodhicitta integrated. There's always form as well as emptiness. Ultimate bodhicitta is what permeates all of our relative experience. So I'm going to go on since we just have about 20 minutes left. And so we're going to look at verses 23 and 24 again. We looked at verse 23 last week, and we just actually read it. I just realized we did that. So we encounter a pleasant experience. And what do we do with a pleasant experience? We appreciate its pleasantness. We appreciate its beauty. We appreciate its delicious taste. And we don't cling on to it as something real or something solid or something that we must have all the time. When it's gone, we let it go. And we talked a lot more about that last week. And whatever commentaries you have, very good to review those for more specific advice on how to carry that out. So verse 24, the new verse today, is the counterpart of 23. So that's what we do with pleasure. What do we do with pain? What do we do with illness? What do we do with loss of, you know, our pension? All forms of suffering are just like dreaming that my beloved child has passed away, which is like the worst dream you could have, right? You know, if you don't have a child, you still can imagine what that would feel like. Maybe you have a dog, you know, there's someone that you love so much that like their loss would be like the worst. It would be so devastating. It would be the worst thing that could possibly happen to you. You can't imagine how you would keep going in those circumstances. And then you wake up and it was a dream. So this is saying that all of our experience is equivalent to having that experience in a dream. So he goes on to say, appearances like these, even like your child dying, appearances like these are just delusions. To take them as true drains my energy. It wears us out. That's what wears us out, is dealing with all of this turmoil as if it were ultimately true, completely solid, permanent thing. So what do we do when something bad happens? When I encounter adverse circumstances, to see them as delusions of my mind. This is Loya Bodhisattva trains. And again, it goes back to Charlotte's question. From the ultimate reality point of view, it's a delusion. And by keeping that in mind, it lessens our suffering. But the thing still happened. Like in a dream, it didn't happen. You wake up and thank God it was just a dream. In this level of dreaming, it's not quite that simple, but we still have to deal with the thing. But remembering that in some way it's our mind that we're dealing with. It's a delusion. It's not a permanent thing. It's not a solid thing. The flow goes on. You know, it will be 5 years later. By tomorrow, it'll be 5 years later. By remembering all of those things, by remembering the ultimate bodhicitta aspect, then things cause us less suffering. And that's the Four Noble Truths, right? First noble truth, there is suffering. Second noble truth, it has a cause. What is the cause? It's clinging to things as ultimately real when they're not. Third noble truth, suffering has a cessation, meaning we don't have to suffer. And the fourth noble truth is, how do we bring that about? How do we make suffering cease? By following the path. This is the path. The 37 practices is the path. It is a complete expression of the path to full awakening. And that is really understanding the relationship between relative reality and ultimate reality. So these are very important verses. We only have 15 minutes left. And again, if anybody has anything they want to say, you're absolutely welcome to do that. If you don't, we're going to look at the commentaries a little bit. Dingo Chensi Rinpoche's commentary, if anybody doesn't have that, I have a note on the book. If anybody doesn't have the book yet, no worries. But this is the main book that we're using, so I recommend that everybody has it. I'm just going to read a couple of lines from this because I want to get to a couple of other things. But he says, I've lost my place. So it starts on page 147, verse 24. So he says, faced with the prospect of something unpleasant happening to you, the usual reaction is to do everything possible to avert it. So let's think about that. How do we usually react? What is our first reaction when something bad happens? What are the stages? Denial, anger, et cetera, yeah, we deny it. Denial is big. Like, no, that's not really happening. It must not be true. And then you're angry at it and so forth. And you do everything that you can to avoid anything bad happening or to get away from it while it's happening. He says, whatever might be threatening you, whether sickness, poverty, or some emotionally unbearable situation, it would surely be unworthy of a person like you to be overcome by such a thing, you think. So you muster all your energy and resources, seek help from influential people, call your congressman or congresswoman, and do all you can to fight it off. In doing so, to give free rein to your attachment and hatred seems quite justifiable. So there are many situations where we think like anger is justified and fighting this thing is justified. And I'm not saying that there aren't situations where we might have to intervene and actually do something. We've talked about that a lot. But if we're reacting from an emotional point of view, it's not going to lead to a good end. So Dingo Chensei says, in reality, however, through this process, you have simply become the slave of your negative emotions. Try as you might to avoid or overcome unfavorable circumstances, there will always be more. They can never be completely eliminated. Takes us back to verse 20. The more we fail to tame our inner anger, the more outer enemies multiply. We get rid of outer enemies only by taming our own anger. He says, the best way to deal with anything undesirable that happens to you is to reflect that this is the result of your own negative actions in the past. So remembering karma, we've seen again and again, remembering karma is a good first reaction to have when something bad happens. It turns you back into yourself. It's the same as drive all blame into one, really. It's like, it's ego clinging. It's me. It's something karmic that I did. One of my friends in three-year retreat got through her whole three-year retreat like that. Everything bad that happened, every time somebody did something to upset her, she would think, I must have done something like this to someone before. And so this is my own karma. So we see that again and again in Dingo Chensei. Remember karma. What else can we do is, right. And then we invoke taking and sending. You know, take a point. Remember that you're not the only one suffering like this. This is so helpful. Simply to open up your experience enough, like detach yourself enough from your, you know, being sucked into this experience to remember that other people are having the suffering too. And then what do? You apply taking and sending. You take their suffering into your suffering and hope that they will be freed, aspire that they will be freed from their suffering by your going through this suffering. So I'm going to skip most of it since we don't have much time, but one of the really helpful things that he says is when bad things happen to us, the best thing we can do is remain simply present and not lose control of ourselves, not lose control to whatever emotion we're feeling. We have so many tools we can apply to those emotions. We change the channel. We replace anger with compassion. I mean, you can actually do that through force of will. And you might have to keep doing it again and again because the anger comes back. But every time you turn to compassion and remember something nice the person did for you before, it weakens it. Or we can look directly at the emotion. That's the ultimate bodhicitta way of doing it. Just rest in it. Get rid of the storyline and rest in the feeling of the emotion. So many ways to be simply present and remain aware, not lose your awareness of ultimate bodhicitta, of the emptiness, and also of relative bodhicitta, of the compassion that we are trying to cultivate. So I think I'm going to abandon Dingo Chensei here. Everybody has the commentary or will have it, and I really recommend that you read it at least once, and preferably two or three times on different days, because you let a little time pass, you come back to it, it's fresh again, and you see it more deeply. Really use these commentaries, whatever commentaries you have, read them again and again. So I wanted to turn to Kenpo Sultram Jamso Rinpoche, whose 37 practices teachings. He's one of the early teachers who brought this practice to the West. And it's his book that I use for the Tibetan when I translate. So for verse 24, he says, all suffering. Oh, and I will just share, which I may have shared before, that in one of his, I went to his teachings. He taught at KTC like every year, like for 2 weeks most years, for like 15 years in the 80s and 90s. And one time, he always says this. This is one of the things he says in every teaching. All suffering is delusive, like the suffering in a dream. All appearances are delusive and confused, like the appearances in a dream. And so somebody asked him one time, because he would say it different ways, different times, somebody said, is it like a dream or is it a dream? And he said, it is a dream. We can't say what he means, right? You can't say, but he said it. He said it very boldly. It is a dream. So all of our suffering is an illusion. It's just like being in a dream. And he says, life will exhaust you if you do not recognize this. He's just here restating what verse 24 actually says. So he says, so do not take delusive appearances to be true. Meaning, again, you know, getting back to Charlotte's clarification, do not take delusive appearances to be ultimately true. Relatively, you got to deal with them. You can't get rid of them. But to know that they're ultimately not true, they're not the whole story, is how we get through it without exhausting ourselves. He says, recognize whatever difficulties and obstacles you meet as delusion. Very strong wording. It's a delusion, it's a hallucination. He says, however, it is not enough to glibly think, oh, it's only an illusion. Not enough just to remember it. He says, conviction is needed that this is actually the case. How do we develop conviction? First, correctly analyze why the situation and all its appearances are delusive. This means applying your own experience to the Buddha's teaching that appearances do not truly exist. This is the contemplation part. So the study part is being able to say, oh, it's only an illusion. That's what verse 24 says. The contemplation part is, how is this true in my experience? Let me look at my experience and examine the truth of this. Like, is it true or not? And that's how we reach conviction. Right. This means applying your own experience to the Buddhist teaching that appearances do not truly exist. That's contemplation. And as we know from verse 1, we need study, contemplation, and meditation. If we leave out any one of those elements, we are not going to wake up completely. So he says, do this again and again, not just one time, but again and again. And we get lots of practice. Adversity happens all the time, right? He says, eventually you will develop a firm conviction that waking experience is no different from the dream state. So he says it again here. It is a dream. It's the same as a dream. Then, when difficult circumstances actually arise, you will know they are delusions. If you remind yourself enough, then when the bad thing happens, that is the first thing that will pop into your mind. Verse 24, it's a delusion. That is how I get through this. In some sense, this is a dream. So you will know they are delusions, and you will be able to apply the real practice of a bodhisattva. So what he's saying here is, first we have to remember it's like an illusion, it's like a dream, it's like a delusion, it is a delusion. And then we got to roll up our sleeves and actually engage with it. And I read this in DC recently from Sita Rinpoche's book, his commentary on the third Karmapa's Mahamudra prayer. He gives some advice along these lines that I have always remembered. He says, whatever it took Milarepa to become enlightened, and let's think about what it took Milarepa to become enlightened, like years and years of hard manual labor, bruises and injuries and despair. Whatever it took Milarepa to become enlightened, it will take us too. If we think we will become enlightened by taking a nice warm bath every day, watching television, going to different restaurants and enjoying our life, this is a ridiculous notion. That's what Sita Rinpoche says. Doesn't mean we can't take a warm bath and go to different restaurants. It means we also have to apply. Like when you take that warm bath, you have to remember, this is like a rainbow. That's a pleasant experience. These are pleasant experiences. So we have to apply the teachings and we have to examine all of our experience. This is the work that we have to engage in order to cultivate wisdom and free ourselves and others from samsara. We can enjoy the bath, but we have to analyze the bath like this. When we're taking the bath, we got to remember this is impermanent. This is like a delusory experience. This is a rainbow. Because the message is the same in both verse 23 about pleasant experiences and verse 24 about unpleasant experiences. They're both illusions. We have to remember they're not ultimately real. But because they are relatively real, on the one hand, we can enjoy the pleasant experiences while they last. And on the other hand, we can endure the negative experiences, the adverse experiences, because we know that they're fleeting, not solid, like a dream, and so forth, even if we didn't really get it yet. So here's where the intellect comes in handy. You know, it's we're talking about experience, but intellectually, we're going to get it intellectually before we get it experientially. This is our guide. Like, when the bad thing's happening, it's like a dream. We just have to keep remembering that this is like a dream. We don't know what it means because it hurts so badly. Like, how can this be like a dream that I lost this beloved person or dog or whatever? But if we keep reminding ourselves it's like a dream, we will start eventually to see how it is like a dream and to be able to connect with ultimate reality even in the midst of the worst kinds of relative reality. So I was going to look, we don't have time, sadly, I was going to look at Ken's commentary. If you have Reflections on Silver River, which is a lovely book from the Western point of view, completely expressed from a Western point of view, it's really great. I'm going to see if there's one thing I can read from it. Because he has, so here's his expression of how we deal with adversity in the moment, which is one of his strong suits. He's always giving us an experiential way to deal with whatever the subject of the verse is. He says, when you encounter difficulties, the feelings and stories that arise in reaction, which is where our suffering lies, are just that, feelings and stories. They are whirlwinds of confusion based not in what is actually happening now, but in deeply held beliefs about you and your relationship to the world. This should not be happening. You're going to be thinking that. This should not be happening. I cannot deal with this. So he says, let them swirl like leaves in the wind. So we don't try to stop. It's not about stopping our emotional reactions. It's never about that. That is not going to help us. We let them swirl. The advice often is expressed as drop the storyline. Drop the thoughts that you're thinking and just let the feelings swirl. So let them swirl like leaves in the wind. Sometimes you fall back into them and lose touch with the present, but a moment of recognition always comes. And by now, I'm sure we all know that that is true. You will recognize, even if you're lost for a while in an emotion, you will recognize and your awareness will kick in because we have a lot of practice now with that. So he says, a moment of recognition always comes. Right then, come back to your body, come back to your breath, and rest. Come back to ultimate bodhicitta. Come back to emptiness. Rest in that. Like, where is this happening? I can't say. Rest in that. And it keeps coming back and you keep detaching yourself from the storyline and just coming back to resting. He says, the confusion, the stories, and the feelings are still there. They continue to swirl, but you are not lost in them. And I'm going to be a couple of minutes late just to read the next couple of sentences because they're very helpful continuing this way of dealing with adversity. He says, just rest. Do not try to control your feelings. Open to all the stories and feelings as much as you can without being consumed by them. You will experience shock, disorientation, anger, and self-blaming, which are reactive mechanisms that protect you from the full impact of what has happened. Sit patiently, let it swirl, let your system sort itself out. I think that's really fabulous advice. Can we do that? Let's find out. We'll report back next week if anybody has an experience that they can apply that to. Please feel free to share it with us next week. I'm seeing if there's anything else we need to mention. No, anything else I will just put in the post about verse 24. And I do hope in the next week or so to catch up. I'm behind on a couple of the study notes for the verses because of, you know, Rinpoche passing away, his prayer nirvana has taken a lot of my time for the last month or so. But I'll put more up on in the post. Everything we didn't get to today will be in the post. Anybody have anything to say before we do our dedication prayer? Valerie.
When a bad thing happens, can you have like a basic belief that there's value in it?
You could. That's very helpful. That's definitely part of the teaching. Pema Chodron says whatever our experience is our teacher in that moment. Mm-hmm. And it really helps to see it that way. And that's actually in a couple of the Bodhisattva Bootcamp verses. That is, you know, see this person who's tormenting you as your teacher. That's the actual advice. So the adversity itself can also be our teacher. And I think, yes, we can learn from it. And if we approach it from a point of view, what can I learn from this? How can I turn this into the Dharma path? That's the most valuable way that we can relate to it at all. Anybody else? Dan.
Yeah, I recently at work have had issues with some people. And then as my teacher, I realized my own arrogance was a lot of it, actually. So,
yeah.
Very helpful.
Yes, it all comes down to awareness, like what's really happening in this moment and where's the ego clinging? Like that's right. The question you can always ask and you always get an answer if you look. It's like where's the, like all the suffering really comes from ego clinging, which is why is this happening to me? I don't deserve it. Thank you, Dan. And I hope things get better at work.
Yes, my teachers have helped me.
Yes. All right, anybody else have anything? Okay, I don't see anybody. So I'm going to bring back the screen share since I haven't sent the prayers to everybody. And we will do the dedication of merit. We'll do all four verses of the dedication. Let's take a moment, though. We've been having an animated discussion. Let's just take one moment to reground ourselves in our body, sitting on the seat with our feet on the floor, fully in the present moment, fully aware, vast, limitless awareness, filled with beings who are suffering, limitless. And we will dedicate any benefit from this study, contemplation, and meditation to their awakening, including our own. This merit, may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy. Then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntus, Anko, and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate, the blessings of the Buddhakayas, the blessings of changeless dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast sangha, this dedication please fulfill. So letting our minds come to rest one more time. Taking our awareness of ultimate bodhicitta, which never needs to be interrupted, though it will be as we train on the path, taking that out into all of our experiences of relative reality for the next week, and we will reconvene again next Thursday for the beginning of the paramitas, six paramitas next. So everybody please read the commentary on verse 25 by Dengo Chensei, Rinpoche, and any other commentaries you may have. Think about your experience this week and about the intersection of relative and ultimate bodhicitta. See how you work with that in your own experience, and see you next week. Oh, let me unmute everybody in case you want to say anything. All right, everybody's unmuted.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good week. Night, Chan Boy.